Gentlemen may prefer blondes, but lionesses prefer brunettes. Happy Pride Month, everybody. Today we're talking prides, manes, and other cool facts about the world's most unique big cat. Now, I just want to preface today, since we're talking about lions and social dynamics, we are going to get into some language that is, it sounds very, what's the word? Anthropogenic? I try to use the most impartial.
Anthropomorphic.
Not anthropogenic. We're anthropomorphizing. Now, I'm going to try to use as unbiased language as possible, but I feel like when you talk about social dynamics in particular, it's sometimes that language isn't always available. So when we talk about things like dominance or even like interspecies like conflicts or killing, you know, it's hard to remove like morality from it, if that makes sense. But we're talking animals and we know that they don't have the same good and bad that we have. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. I'm going to do my best to keep this as objective as possible today. There is a certain charm to lion prides that have inspired great works of fiction and wonder. In fact, lion prides tend to stand alone as an entirely unique structure in the animal kingdom. Within felids, social structures tend to have a pattern. Adults are solitary unless it's a female with cubs. Lion prides are considered a fission-fusion society. This means that the size and composition of the social group changes as time passes and animals move throughout their environment. Animals merge into a group, i.e. fusion, or they split, fission. Prides in their whole comprise of 4 to 6 related females, their dependent offspring, and temporarily around 2 unrelated adult males. When the young grow up, females largely stay within their natal pride, but all males typically leave. These prideless males live in coalitions from 1 to 10 individuals, with larger coalitions usually only existing when all the members are related, whereas smaller groups may be all unrelated males from different prides. Larger coalitions have the advantage of having higher reproductive success, but that is usually confided to like the strongest and like most healthiest, better fit of the larger coalition. So they have that competitive advantage of size, but usually they have the benefit fit of more reproductive success, and they usually get like the prey first kind of thing, if that makes sense. But the smaller groups have a more evenly distributed reproductive success among members, even though they may mate less overall than the larger coalitions. Infanticide is another really significant aspect of pride dynamics. Infanticide just referring to like, and this sounds very brutal again, but we're not establishing morality to these animals. And I think the more we talk about it and its genetic implications, it gets really interesting. Mm-hmm. In a trying not to think of it in its morbid way, but infanticide just refers to like a large-scale killing of offspring of young.
That's really common in the animal kingdom. Like infanticide, like you see it in bears, and it's all just about like this need for survival too, I would assume.
There's a couple different reasons that infanticide can happen, and we're going to talk about 2 big ones, but one of the, there's, I guess, I can start to talk about it a little bit, but the 3 reasons are kind of like removing competition, genetic control, resetting the reproductive instincts in females.
Interesting.
So like you talked about with bears, I believe that's kind of one of the reasons they think that male bears will kill off cubs with a female, because when they kill off the cubs, it will reset the female's ability to mate. Male coalitions may perform a behavior referred to as pride takeovers, in which they overpower the residing male coalition of a pride to mate with the females. However, females will not mate until their offspring are 18 months old, like I just said. Therefore, males will kill all residing cubs, thus reinstating the female's mating instincts. It is also thought this behavior, just like I said before, controls the gene pool, allowing only the genetics of the strongest male coalition to prevail.
I'm just wondering, you said like it resets the female's instinct to breed. Would that be like over a course of time, or is it like right away?
I'm not sure how fast it happens, because I'm actually going to get into this in just a minute. But females like are resistant to this, of course.
Yeah.
Like they obviously don't want their cubs to be killed.
Yeah.
So
I'm just, it's interesting because I always, like, I know we're not supposed to anthropomorphize mm-hmm. animals, but I just wonder how animals take loss in the same way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. if they see their dead cub, are they going to want to breed right away, or are they going to want to wait, like, a while before they breed?
That's definitely an interesting thought, because I feel like recently, I feel like I hear this in whales a lot, mm-hmm. this idea that whales likely grieve to some extent. Yeah. So to see how a female's ability to mate, I don't think it's observed in, at least from what I've seen, has been observed in felids or in lions in particular, I guess.
I know it does happen in whales.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah, well, just like when I was doing my research for my last episode, she was studying whales, and she found when her babies died, she would go down to the bottom of the pool for multiple days. Well, she mm-hmm. would come up to breathe, but that would be the only time. And her male partner would try to do this call to get her to respond. And it took a while for her to actually respond to the call, and then go up, and they would go around doing that one call over and over again.
I'm sure there's studies being looked into this. I wonder if there's a certain level of intellect and social development for that to take into effect. Because that seems like such a sophisticated emotion, grief so much that it impacts sexual receptibility. Moving on, females also have a very interesting relationship with infanticide. Mothers will directly defend their cubs from infanticidal males. As well, females without cubs, now I feel like this is going to be kind of complicated to understand, but I'm going to try to put it out simply. Females without cubs, so they have not, bred yet, will, if they're within a pride that has a coalition that's maybe not as well fit, they will make encounters with rival coalitions. They'll it's thought that they incite competition when they don't have cubs to make sure that their cubs are not only better fit themselves, but are in a pride with better fit coalitions, so that they are less likely to be victim to a pride takeover. Now, this obviously seems like a lot of speculation, but I think you can see how females might incite more of that competition when they don't have cubs with them, undertake that more risky behavior kind mm-hmm. of thing.
Yeah.
It's thought to be a method of enforcing not only better genes, but reducing the likelihood of an infanticide. Female lions also take part in genetic control by killing cubs in rival prides, which is really interesting. But the most interesting thing about that is that they will not kill their pride mate's cubs. This may not sound like a super out to lunch thing that they wouldn't kill their sisters and aunts and cousins' mm-hmm. cubs, but when you think about other social terrestrial carnivores, such as canines, this is not typical yeah. at all. So when you talk about wild dogs is something I'm a bit more familiar with their social structure. I just saw a presentation on it somewhat recently in one of my classes. But there's a dominant female who will mate with the dominant male, and then they will have all of the puppies in a group. Mm-hmm. But if a subordinate female within the group has puppies, she will kill the puppies. It seems that within the social group of lions, all of the females and their cubs are somewhat on the same level. There's not a dominant female lioness.
Okay.
In the case of a pride takeover, like I had said earlier, their mating instinct somewhat resets, and all females will typically give birth around the same time after mating with a new resident coalition. These cubs will form what is referred to as a creche. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, but this just refers to a group of mothers and young, which will be communally raised and communally nursed. They typically stick together, and this is advantageous because mothers who do not produce enough milk can rely on pride mates to feed their cubs, and it also helps as a defensive strategy against outer pride lions and lionesses that might try to, infiltrate.
So if one mother, one female the lioness, gets killed for some reason, mm-hmm. will those pride mates take over her cubs for her?
I believe so.
Interesting.
I think it's thought that they still prioritize the ones that they gave birth to, but they said it had been observed that a mother with one cub and then a mother with three cubs, the mother with one cub would share her milk with the mother with three cubs. Prides rarely move as one, but move within subunits as they partake in different types of behaviors. These behaviors can include rest, communal cub raising, breeding, hunting, kill defense, and cub defense. In West African regions, lion populations are somewhat struggling compared to their other regional counterparts. Therefore, these prides may look a little different than the typical healthy archetype that I've just laid out of prides and then, you know, multiple male coalitions, you know, occupying a similar area. Lions across Africa occupy various habitat types, including arid deserts, seasonally flooded wetlands, and dense thickets. Lions are highly territorial, with larger prides having a big advantage in occupying territory due to their size, but have the pitfall of needing to share prey. Lion territory usually depends on proximity to river systems, which funnel prey into small areas to be hunted. A lineage of lionesses may occupy the same territory for generations. The lion, Panthera leo, is the newest to evolve among the felids. Early lions may date back to the late Pliocene, and cave paintings from that period did not indicate that they had manes. Charles Darwin hypothesized that manes acted as an armor, as defense in intraspecific fights. The big question surrounding manes is if they are truly a result of better fares in male-on-male fights, or if they are the result of female sexual selection, somewhat like with, I feel like the big sort of textbook example of this is like antlers. A lot of people think antlers are like a direct result of female sexual selection. For those of you who don't know, interspecific fights refer to a fight between two members of different species. But intraspecific fights, like we're talking about right now, refers to a conflict between two different organisms of the same species. Arguments for the armor theory include that some findings suggests that fatal injuries from lion fights more often involve the head and nape. Much of this seems to come from lions' confrontation strategy of like face-to-face fights, rarely turning from an attacker, thus reducing targets besides the head and nape. The neck and head are also very vulnerable parts of the body, making it more likely for an injury in that area to be fatal. Another prominent point used in evidence for the armor argument is the maneless Tsavo lions in Kenya. These lions are thought to have adapted to the increased heat of the equator to be maneless, and this has greatly affected their social structure. Tsavo lions are less likely to live in mixed-sex, multi-male prides relying on size as an advantage, as seen in maned lions. Instead, they are more likely to live in male coalitions, or a single male among females, rather than the typical 2+. This is not to say that there is less conflict in maneless males, but rather that the presence of manes clearly have a significant impact on social structure, with maneless males seeming to choose to either live only among males or only among females.
Isn't that maneless? So I kind of think, I was thinking about this when you were talking about the mane for armor theory. Wasn't it like a theory that like beards evolved because it was protection?
Oh, Clara, I was just getting to that.
Oh my god!
In a somewhat strange addition to the argument, and I must preface this holds zero weight, the human equivalent of a mane is arguably a beard, wouldn't you say, Clara? Appears only in males, typically, comes about at puberty. Well, the International Amateur Boxing Association prohibits beards in boxing matches due to their defensive advantage.
Exactly what I'm saying.
So clearly facial hair is an advantage in fights, right? Anyways. I read a few studies on this idea of manes correlating with having a better chance in surviving encounters with other males, but most results were pretty inconclusive. I read a bunch of studies on whether injuries were more likely to be in that head and nape area, or if they were more likely to be fatal in that head and nape area, and like maneless ant, and it was all mostly inconclusive. Apparently some suggest that there's like somewhat of a correlation, but it's wishy-washy, kinda at best. So, I think the jury's still out on that one. Arguments for the female choice narrative include a strange and interesting study done by West and Packer in 2002, in which dummies with varying mane lengths and color were observed to see which were more often approached by females. This study showed longer and darker manes were significantly more approached than their shorter or lighter counterparts. indicating females have a preference for males with traits associated with fitness. Darker colored manes are thought to be caused by higher testosterone levels and are used as a sensitive indicator of male lion health. So I would like to know, what do you think it is, Clara?
I think it's more likely. I mean, who's to say it's not a combination of two or more than two
things? I think that's very likely the answer.
But, like, from the evidence that you presented, I feel like I'm leaning a little bit, like, maybe it has a little bit more to do with, like, that sexual selection and a little less to do with the armor, but still, like, that's, like, highly relevant, but also just a little more to do with sexual selection because it's observed in so many other organisms. I feel like maybe that might be a better thing. And it's so interesting that they only evolved so recently.
Like, yeah, it was so a very recent evolution. And it's also thought that it is somewhat of a maladaption because even though these darker manes and longer manes are associated with very good health in lions, those longer and darker manes are actually very prone to overheating.
Yeah.
Especially as you get closer to the equator.
Yeah. And maybe it was just, like, an accident. Like, you know, maybe it doesn't really serve that much of a purpose if there's still lions who are maneless. Like, maybe the purpose isn't that strong, but maybe it is. I don't know.
In my personal opinion, I think it is less that manes are cause a better, and I think this is kind of the more accepted theory, and that's probably why, just because I've read more than you have at this point, it's that it's not necessarily that manes provide an armor, but rather that if you have a better mane, you are in better health, and therefore you probably are going to fare better in a fight.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the way it goes, and of course females are going to want the best health male.
Yeah.
For better faring, both in their offspring and in just their pride dynamics.
Yeah.
Moving on, we have a very interesting story that I've learned somewhat recently, and I think will be a very strange and fun addition to our wealth of lion knowledge that we are delving into. In the Okavango Delta in Botswana, a new observation in lion behavior and presentation was recorded by Gil Fillion et al. In 2016, in which five maned lionesses were identified. Four of the lionesses had developed short, light-colored manes below the neck, with one growing a large, long, dark-colored mane named Mamariri. The lionesses were observed to still mate with males, but females on occasion would try to mate with the maned lionesses, which were met with either aggression or ambivalence. Although the maned lionesses frequently mated with males, none seem to get pregnant. Vocalization is thought to be important to lion communication, but males do so in a much higher frequency than females. These maned lionesses vocalize more similarly to males. The study concluded with suggesting maned lionesses maintain a similar pride role, but that this presentation had some sort of relationship with infertility.
Could it be that they have, like, an increased testosterone level? Like, would it be that testosterone is causing this?
Well, let's see. In 2022, Mitchell et al. Investigated this phenomenon further. I think we both know from our biology studies that biology is not as simple as some people like to think. The article by Mitchell et al. In 2022 starts like this. Until recently, mammalian sex differentiation was thought to be finalized in the embryo. Development of the tubular genital tract, external genitalia, secondary sexual characteristics, and sexual behavior are largely determined by the developing gonad. In the last decade, however, it has been shown that continuous sex maintenance is required throughout life. We document proposed ovary to testes transdifferentiation in six captive African lionesses. So, what is ovaries to testes transdifferentiation? It's a big, long statement. In this case, it involves phenotypical lionesses developing clitoromegaly, meaning an enlarged clitoris, behavioral changes, higher testosterone, and lack of ovarian follicles, and the development of Sertoli-like cells. Do you know what Sertoli cells are? Do you remember from, like, high school? Or maybe this was, like, first...
biology.
Oh, you didn't?
No. Nope.
Okay, so Sertoli cells are, they're, like, they're only, well, first of all, naturally, they're only in males. And I think they're within the testicles associated with sperm production.
Okay.
So these were, like, all XX females. And they were just sort of spontaneously had started creating cells associated with sperm production. However, Sertoli-like cell development, interestingly, has been well documented in human women, but it has been found in lesions and tumors within the reproductive system. So that's sort of how that happens in women, if that makes sense, in like human women. These lionesses had oviohysterectomies performed, following which their masculine traits ceased. Some of the lionesses in this scenario had birthed cubs previously, sort of dispelling that infertility theory mm-hmm. that they had had previously. And like I said earlier, had XX chromosomes. This also showed that this was not a disorder of sexual differentiation, which is sometimes referred to as intersex in humans. This occurs when someone or something is born with absent genitalia, genitalia with both male and female traits, or I guess it can also present as like, it looks like one thing, but internally there's something else going on. It can look like a whole spectrum of things, if that makes sense. And it can affect person to person very differently. And I feel like I also want to point out is incredibly common. I think it occurs in like 1.7% of the population. Like we all likely know someone with some form of intersex, but I feel like it's not something that's talked about a lot. Anyways, now that that's out of the way, this condition was not necessarily the case here, although it was a very prominent theory. While the study couldn't declare for certain the cause, it was likely due to increased testosterone released by the ovary, which was, of course, ended when they removed the ovaries from the lions. As well, the lack of follicles was thought to be due to a contraceptive treatment that these lionesses were receiving, unrelated to their maned nature. So, I hoped you learned a thing or two about lions' manes and their pride dynamics. Let's get into trivia.
Trivia!
Bauer et al. In 2014 found the sex ratio within Panjaro Nature Reserve in Benin. In both national park zones as well as hunting zones, so this is hunting for lions, like trophy hunting. What do you think the sex ratio looked like within the national park versus the hunting zone? So I'm just looking for like more males or more females. In the national park?
In the national park, I think it was more females to males. And in the hunting area, it was more males to females.
That is exactly right. Why did you think that, might I ask?
Because where you have females and prides, they might be easier hunting compared to like trying to go out and try to find males in smaller groups.
Okay.
Whereas females in national parks are more protected. And like we've talked about in the whale episode, actually, is you need more females to increase population dynamics. So I thought maybe that might also have something to do with it.
Okay, so these findings were actually really bizarre. It shouldn't have been this, if that makes sense. It should have been more females in both.
Yeah.
Ideally. Because more females because they have, I guess, that kind of, they don't deal with the same kind of competition that the males do in a natural, healthy environment. Whereas in the hunting zone, I should mention, you probably wouldn't have known this, and I didn't until I started reading. So you only trophy hunt males, first of all. They're like the desirable. They're not only desirable, but that's the only thing legal for you to hunt in these hunting zones. But they had found that they weren't meeting their hunting quotas because it was so difficult to actually find a lion that was suited. It had to be like in the age range. It had to be in the, you know, size range and that sort of thing. So there actually wasn't enough of the males to be hunting them, if that makes sense.
Okay.
They found that this was just sort of a case of poor management, and the study was kind of used to say, hey, we need to be altering this a bit. There should be more females in both. There's no reason there should be more males on the hunting side kind of thing. You need to, you know, improve the health of your populations.
So were people hunting the females?
They had hypothesized that there was probably a poaching aspect to it as well, but you can't really know that for sure within the, like, they can't state for certain that is the case. Another case was recorded of a single lioness within the Oklahoma Zoo experiencing masculinization. However, this was due to a tumor in her what gland? Her pituitary gland, her pineal gland, her thymus, or her adrenal gland? I'm getting into endocrinology, my least favorite chapter.
Why you gotta go ask me questions like this? Let's take a wild guess. Give me two guesses. Let's go with pituitary.
It's not the pituitary.
Adrenal.
It's the adrenal. That's right. Those are kind of, I feel like those are the two big glands. Like they do a lot of stuff.
What's the adrenal gland?
That's associated with your kidneys.
Okay.
It's like sits kind of on top. It's pretty well known that lionesses are the primary hunters in prides. True or false, when required to hunt for themselves, male lions are less successful than their female counterparts.
True.
It's false.
What?
It was really commonly thought, though, for a long time, but some new studies are starting to say that they probably have a similar success rate.
Okay.
When lionesses hunt, they do so cooperatively, each repeating a similar role in different hunts. True or false? True. It is true. So they actually, they called it a wing and center pattern. Okay. So there are some lionesses who will go at the wings and they will kind of surround a group of prey. And then some will go in the center and go for the kill, if that makes sense.
Yep. What a great strategy, honestly.
Yeah. I think that's a good one. I think that's probably a pretty common one. It's time for Right Whale Watch. Do you remember in our last episode, our right whale episode, the story I told you about the lobster fisherman?
Yeah.
Just to give a brief recap, DFO had thought there was a right whale who was under a threshold of depth and required fishermen to pull up their lobster traps for 2 weeks, which would have cost them millions of dollars. And it turns out their maps were wrong, and the fishermen didn't need to pull up their traps. And the fishermen knew this because they had, you know, they had the same technology, so they could read where this whale was, if that makes sense. They refused to pull up their traps, and they said, you know, this whale is not, you know, where it needs to be to call for this. And they were right, and, you know, they got their right to put their stuff back was given back to them, kind of thing. Yeah. And we talked about in the last episode how this government negligence drove the wedge between environmentalists and industry, like, deeper. It wasn't the people who are pushing for endangered species to be protected at fault. It was negligence at fault. In response to this, a Liberal MP had called for more flexible to pull back some of these regulations that we have in place to protect right whales as a response to this event, which feels like totally not the way to go here. From just my personal opinion on the matter.
Yeah.
Where a lot of the, I feel like we talk about this, or it's something that has come up in my classes a lot. A lot of regulation, especially about protecting species, is very wishy-washy. It is not concrete. And worst of all, it's not enforced. So to pull that further, or to suggest that we should be pulling it back further, feels like it's doing much more harm than good and is a big step in the wrong direction.
If anything, I feel like we should be making these restrictions more clear and more clearly defined.
Exactly.
Then pulling them back. So that doesn't sit very well with me, I think.
Yeah, maybe this wasn't the best right whale news, but there's not often very much good right whale news.
Yeah.
But that's what I have for today. I hope you enjoyed listening, everyone, and we hope this episode was
right up your algae.